The Allegretto from Dmitri Shostakovich's Symphony No. 5, Opus 47. We heard Lauren Mazel conducting the Cleveland Orchestra. And with me is internationally renowned conductor Lauren Mazel. Mazel has been artistic director of the Berlin Opera, music director of the Cleveland Orchestra, and general manager and artistic director of the Vienna State Opera. Throughout most of his career, he's also traveled extensively, guest conducting the top orchestras around the world. Mazel has made many records. Over 2 million records featuring him were sold in 1985. He's also reached new audiences through his conducting in the films of the operas Carmen, Otello, and Don Giovanni, and through his many television appearances. His many honors include the Bambi Award as the most popular musician on television in Europe. Currently, Mazel is music consultant to the Pittsburgh Symphony and conducts opera at La Scala. He's in Philadelphia to conduct the Opera Company of Philadelphia's concert performance of Verdi's Requiem, featuring Luciano Pavarotti and the three winners of the Opera Company's Luciano Pavarotti International Voice Competition, plus a chorus of 350 voices. The performance is this Saturday night at 8:30 at the Spectrum, and it will get videotaped for broadcast on Wednesday, June 11th on public television. By the way, for more information about this performance, you can call 732-5813. That's 732-5813. Lauren Mazel, welcome to Fresh Air.
Well, it's lovely to be here.
When was it discovered that you first had musical talent? Did you find out you had perfect pitch at a young age or anything like that?
Well, doting parents always discover all kinds of wonderful things in their children. And my parents, of course, were no different than the rest of us, certainly not different, any different than I am, and with regard to my own children. But, of course, the musical talent does show up at a very early age, and soon they discovered that I had a good ear and seemed to have a musical bent and a musical gift, and I was soon playing the violin. I would think when I was 5 or 6 and started piano lessons a little later, the usual musical story. And were it not for my father's odd idea that I might have conducting talent as well, I think I would have gone on, as most musical youngsters do, just playing instruments and perhaps coming to conducting much later in life than I actually did.
Your father had been in show business. He was an actor and had small parts in several movies.
Yes, in fact, a few big parts. He was a gymnast and the Schwarz and whatever his name is of his time, because he, you know, lifted weights.
Schwarzenegger?
Yeah, Schwarzenegger, right. And he played opposite Grace Moore in a major film. And he's still alive and from time to time still does some character parts in the theater.
Did he want you to go into show business or any kind of performing?
No, I don't think he wanted me to go into anything. But apparently, because I was waving my hands around the living room conducting our German Shepherd in the corner, whom I designated as the first violin section, to the strains of Haydn's Surprise Symphony, he came to the rather odd conclusion that I had conducting talent.
Well, it is interesting that you started conducting as young as you did. I know that there are many conductors who start conducting after they realize that they're not going to have a career as a soloist, and they frequently start very, very late comparatively. And you were conducting by the time you were 8. You were guest conducting university symphonies, and I think at 13 or something, the New York Philharmonic. How did you cultivate the talent once your father thought that you had it?
Well, he was wise enough to bring me to a professional conductor, one Vladimir Bakalennikov, who was the brother of Konstantin Bakalennikov, who was music director of RKO Studios at that time. And Vladimir thought that I really did have conducting talent and had me conduct his student orchestra in Moscow. Mind you, Moscow, Idaho, not Moscow, Moscow, where he was a professor of music. And then I was taken by him to the Interlaken Music Camp in 1939, where I conducted a concert, Mendelssohn's Italian Symphony and such. And we all went to New York, to the New York World's Fair, where I conducted the orchestra. In one of the pavilions, I met the Little Flower, the mayor, Fiorello, LaGuardia, and he thought I was pretty good, and I thought he was pretty good. I was very politically aware at that time. Read Time magazine, and I think I was more interested in politics than music. So it went on from there. Major articles written in the New York Times, and over the next 5 years, while people were dying in Europe during the Second World War, I was conducting major orchestras here in the United States.
How did you get authority over an orchestra when you were 9 or 12?
Well, it was something that I found myself doing, as you would find yourself playing baseball or whatever, something that I could do quite well, apparently. And musicians, because of their access to the non-rational intelligence, do respond intuitively to music making. And they just saw this little kid up there waving his arms around rather intelligently, apparently, and saying musical things when he stopped the orchestra. I obviously knew my marbles and had the score very much under control. And so they were, generally speaking, rather nice to me. And during the 5 or 6 years that I pursued this child prodigy career, I had a few, if any, untoward incidents.
Did you give up the prodigy part of your childhood?
Well, I really wasn't a bona fide prodigy in that I went to school like every red-blooded and almost red-blooded American kid, played baseball and was center in our football team and so forth. And I gave concerts during the summer months. I gave about 9 or 10 concerts a year rather than the 60, 70, or 80 that most kids are asked to do when they're being exploited by their parents. So that when I was no longer a curiosity, I was able to finish high school very normally, go to college, study philosophy, and think about pursuing another career. I was offered a math scholarship to Harvard, which I didn't take advantage of, fortunately, because, in fact, I soon discovered that I really did love music very much, but one has to rediscover such things as an adult. And soon found myself thinking very seriously about music, and then went to Europe on a Fulbright, do some research in old Italian music, and I was off and running.
Was there a point in your life where you knew as an adult that this wasn't just a childhood interest, where, as you said, you rediscovered your interest in music or reaffirmed your interest in music?
Well, there's always somebody standing on your road at the right time. Who says the right word. I greatly admired the Italian conductor Victor de Sabata. And at that time, I was putting myself through school by playing in the Pittsburgh Symphony, playing the violin. I was a very good violinist at that time and could have given recitals. In fact, I was, but I wanted to stay home and go to school. So rather than traveling around the circuit, I thought I'd join an orchestra and earn $95 a week. And that was enough to put myself through night school and earn a degree. I also conducted the orchestra very, very rarely. And I think the half a concert a year that I conducted, I was fortunate in having in the audience Maestro de Sabata, who the next day when I went to see him, tell him that I really didn't think I had any talent for music or conducting, said that I was being very foolish, that indeed I did have talent and I should pursue that talent. And to ask oneself what one is doing in life is the sum of egotism. One does what one must do, and you just go out there and do it and leave the evaluating to others. So that's what I did, and I went abroad, and he said, study, learn Italian, go to opera, pull yourself out of your isolation, because after all, I was an American kid, Pittsburgh, land-bound and America-bound, and spoke no foreign languages, knew nothing except music, and, of course, what I had learned in school. And so going abroad was extremely important at that time. There was, no television, no interchange. And Fulbright, whom I had the great joy of thanking personally for this great idea, helped thousands and thousands of youngsters to go out and sharpen their tools and learn. That was terribly important at that time.
You went to Italy on a Fulbright scholarship. Mm-hmm. Did you think that you needed to go to Europe in order to establish yourself in America or Europe as a conductor? Was it essential to go there to study?
Yeah, well, I didn't go there to establish myself as anything. I wasn't interested in a career yet. I was just interested in learning, as I said. And I went there, as I may have mentioned, on a research grant, just to do research in Italian Baroque music. and I started conducting really purely by accident, one of those odd stories. A French conductor had fallen ill, who was to have conducted a concert in Catania, Sicily, about 2 years into my Fulbright scholarship. And it was Christmas Eve, and the agents couldn't find any conductor to replace him. And one of the agents remembered that there was something called the Fulbright Commission, and very often they had musicians, and they called up, and no one knew of any conductors there. But going through the files, they finally discovered that one of the research people, me, had had conducting experience. And so I found myself on a train going down Sicily, and as luck would have it, I had conducted every piece in that program, with the exception of the overture. It was a 17-hour trip, however, down, standing all the way. It's the only reservations available, the only train available. And there it was. I conducted the concert, and apparently very successfully, and news somehow seeped up to Italy, mainland Italy, that he was a young man who knew something about conducting. And 6 months later, I conducted my second concert in a program I'd never conducted before, but I'd conducted very few programs. And that one came off very well, too. And so one concert led to another, so to speak, always somewhat to my great stupefaction. The last thing I really wanted to be doing at that time was conducting orchestras, even though I thought that perhaps I did it rather well, because I'm still under this false impression that one had to be convinced that one had something to say, that one had something to offer. And I wasn't really listening to Maestro de Sabata's advice yet. And so I went sort of from concert to concert, looking backward, and not really knowing why I was conducting these concerts, which apparently was very good, because I communicated enthusiasm for the music and not for the career. And
that's an interesting distinction.
Yeah, and I sort of backed into the career of conducting. It took me several years to realize that I had actually become a professional conductor.
Well, you became the first conductor under 30, and I think the first American conductor to conduct at Bayreuth.
Yeah, well, by the time I was 30, I had... I found myself having broken the youth barrier, because at that time, if you think back, there were no young conductors. The young conductor was a contradiction in terms.
Is that because you were supposed to have accumulated a certain amount of wisdom and over the years before you could conduct, or were they just older? I mean, was
it because the schooling at that time, that is before the Second World War, was such that no one dreamt of presenting himself professionally before the public before his early 30s. They all went through an apprenticeship, that is, in the old German opera houses, and they would be the third assistant corps repetiteur, and then the second, and the first, and occasionally they get a chance to conduct a rehearsal, and then perhaps an odd performance, and it went on from there. All of them, Brunewald to Furtwängler, Toscanini, got their start that way. And they would sort of grow into their careers. Klemperer, Kleiber, all these people, de Sabata. So that it was just considered totally not done to have a young conductor under the age of 30 conduct. And actually, with a certain amount of justification, because it does take quite a while to learn your craft. And having the talent is, in fact, a prerequisite. But what you do with that talent requires a great deal of experience and a great deal of tempering and honing. And that's what a lot of young conductors today don't get. Look at all the competition winners who look very good at the finals and then go nowhere because they have no experience, no backup, no training, no schooling. And in fact, our whole conducting situation in terms of preparation is in total chaos. It's very chaotic, the situation. I would love to see something being done about it. One day, perhaps we can sort it out. Very much as Luciano sorting out his problems in his field with his competition, which I think is so amazing.
You spent the first part of your career in Europe, because didn't you? I mean, there was Bayreuth. You'd been in Italy. You became general music director of the West Berlin Opera Company and music director of the Berlin Radio Symphony Orchestra. Was it a bit of a novelty at all to have an American conductor in Europe at the time?
Oh, yes. Well, there were no Americans. There were no young conductors and no Americans. And I was thought of as a kind of European, despite my protestations to the contrary. I had taken the trouble to learn some European languages and spoke them quite well. And the prejudice against Americans was in the cultural field was very strong. We were loved after the Second World War as liberators and as people who came up with the Marshall Plan and all of that. That love faded away, as we may have noticed over the years. And then there was that whole period in which it became very popular not to like Americans at all. And then, of course, there were a lot of Americans who were ashamed of being American, became the so-called expatriates, a term which is no longer around, and nobody even knows what an expatriate is these days. But that time, there were guys who, because Americans didn't have beards, grew beards. They were precursors to the flower children and all those people. All of that's gone now, the Kerouac people. I'm speaking of the 60s. I was just thought of as a musician, accidentally having grown up in America, but really European. And I found that very odd because no one ever felt more American than I did or do. And I went back to the States, curiously enough, as an adult for the first time in 61. That was a year after I appeared in Bayreuth with the National Orchestra of France, sharing a tour with Charles Munch. And I gradually began to guest conduct. Munch asked me to conduct guest conduct in Boston in 62. And then I gradually started to move on, conduct other American orchestras. And in fact, spent a good number of months, a year, towards the end of the 60s, right here in Philadelphia, conducting the Philadelphia Orchestra during a period in which Ormandy was not conducting as much as he had in the past. In fact, at one period, I was here for 2 months.
Did you ever feel in America that there was a predisposition against American composers, that a lot of orchestras really preferred European composers because of the whole aura of being European?
Yeah, well, I found myself in this odd position at that time of being not terribly popular as an American in Europe and not terribly popular as American at home, because at that time we thought that only Europeans could do it right. That's, of course, all behind us. We're now very proud of our own. It certainly took us a long time to discover, in fact, that were it not for America and Americans, there probably would not have been any European culture, because there were no Europeans to further European culture after the Second World War. I mean, the place was really decimated, and most of the singers and a good number of the stage directors and dancers and instrumentalists were American at that time, and we managed to revitalize a culture that in fact had all but died out, so to speak, because really nobody left.
If you're just joining us, my guest is conductor Lorne Mazel, and he's in Philadelphia to conduct the Opera Company of Philadelphia with Luciano Pavarotti and three of the Opera Company's Luciano Pavarotti singers, winners of the competition, this Saturday night in a performance of Verdi's Requiem. It's a concert performance, and it's going to be at the Spectrum this Saturday night at 8:30. Well, you spent 10 years with the Cleveland Orchestra as the director there. Did you want to go to Cleveland? You were succeeding George Zell, and he'd already built the orchestra into an important orchestra. It was a well-recorded orchestra, but you were going, I think, from Europe at the time, right? Were you were living in Europe?
Well, I had just left my job as artistic director of the Berlin Opera, and I had just moved to London. I had put my feet up and said, at last I'm a freelance musician again. And the call came in from Cleveland about 2.5 years after Maestro Zell had passed away. And I really didn't want a job, even a great position such as the music director of Cleveland Orchestra. I felt, look, this is an orchestra in a smaller city. It's an orchestra that needs caring for. And here I am, an American conductor, without a position. The fact that I don't want one is actually nobody's business. I really felt that somehow an obligation to say yes, because at that time the orchestra had fallen, as any orchestra would after the demise of a great leader, on very barren days. You know, there was, the subscription was down to 23%, and they had no recording contracts, no television contracts, no tours. It was an orchestra that was just fading away and was also getting older. And so it struck me that maybe I really ought to roll up my sleeves and help out. And so that's just what I did. And I found an orchestra superbly honed, a little frightened and kind of aggressive.
Aggressive toward you?
Well, not really. Just sort of, you know, as when people who know they're very good and are being sort of forgotten get to be, you know, they would just felt that they, people were, well, Time magazine called them number 13, which is so unfair at that time. And so I tried to rebuild their image as well as do the job that was necessary, because so many musicians were ready for retirement, just to rebuild the orchestra. And so 5 years later, I had the satisfaction of seeing them up to number two, according to Time magazine, and perhaps number one on the level of Chicago, all of which I found considerably unfair for the other great orchestras in this country, because, as you know, Philadelphia is second to none, and there are other great orchestras, Boston and so on. Comparisons are odious, always have been and always will be in art, but people think in those terms, little one could do. But it's a question of image. That's the way people were beginning to see the Cleveland Orchestra again. And our halls were filled. We had 86% subscription, and we were beginning to tour internationally. Two tours to South America, two to Japan, two to Europe, and a great number of tours across the land here.
No matter where you work, whenever you get a new boss, you're always a little nervous. Will they like your work? Will they maybe fire you? Will they change the procedures around in a way that it's going to make you uncomfortable? When you took over the Cleveland Orchestra, when you take over any orchestra, do you have that kind of reaction initially, like, what's the new boss going to want from us, and are we going to like working under him?
Oh, sure. That's inevitable. And especially when you're younger. I'm getting now to the age where sporting quite a few white hairs and looking sort of mellow and speaking rather whimsically about life and things, I don't encounter that anymore, because for better or for worse, I'm a known entity, and so things sort of start off right from the beginning. But when I was younger and very, very serious about my work and very keen and totally devoted to music making and perhaps not quite having the perspective that one gets when one gets older. I think it's great to grow older, as you can see. You're going to meet a lot of antagonism and quite a few of the things that you just referred to. Feeling that, well, maybe this guy is going to exploit us, and maybe he wants too much from us, and perhaps he's he'll never be able to fill the shoes of our great master and so forth. When asked once by a journalist whether I thought I'd ever be able to fill the shoes of Maestro Zell, I said, of course not. I have a different size foot, and I brought my own shoes. And I think that's precisely the way one should feel. I always admired Zell, and I think it was because he worked so long with the orchestra and had made so much of his orchestra, which was a very good orchestra, I might add, before he started to work with it, became a very great orchestra in his hand. It was only for that reason that I pulled myself out of my nice, comfortable London apartment and went over to Cleveland and rolled up my sleeves and said, okay, let's go. I mean, one has to realize that a music director, even at that time, really worked for very modest rewards in terms of career and certainly in terms of money. And I was always very happy to do that and had done so for 20 years because I felt I had a certain obligation to my profession. Music has given me so much, and if I have any talents, administrative or otherwise, well, you just go, and it's like leaving private industry and going into government service. Obviously, you're paid, but it's not like working for General Motors. And as a freelance artist, of course, it's entirely different. And so, you know, I spent 20 years as an administrator and 20 years giving whatever energy I had as an administrator and as a conductor to these jobs. And in fact, I calculated when I finally left Vienna a couple of years ago that I had given approximately 10,000 hours to discussions with unions and to stagehands and to my stage directors and to members of the board, the managers, politicians, visiting firemen and what have you, all activities that one must engage in as a music administrator. I did so very happily, but it was an enormous chunk out of my life and out of my time and out of my space.
Do you consider that part of your life over? Were you going to have a full-time position as a music director of an orchestra? Do you not want to have that kind of, to be that tied down anymore?
Yeah, well, I call myself now a baton for hire. and I must say I'm enjoying it so much. The freedom, the space that I have to move about in my private life, I mean, time that I have to read, go to the theater, enrich myself, just goof off, is fabulous, just wonderful. And I love working now because the only thing I think about is music. And with regard to the future, well, you know, never say never. I have no idea what the future is going to bring. Something may come along that I'll find irresistible. Somebody may make an offer I can't refuse. I doubt it at this point, but, you know, you never know. At this point, however, in my life, I think that I would like to proceed as I'm doing right now because it makes me happy.
You left the Vienna State Opera before your contract had expired. Why did you leave?
Why did I leave? Well, because I had won the battle, and then I found that it was not worth winning. The battle was along very clearly defined lines. Does the government in a government-supported institution have the right to interfere with the artistic freedom of the director of that institution? I was artistic director and general manager of the opera house, and when a new culture minister was appointed, someone who'd never been in an opera house in his life, began to make public statements of an artistic nature, criticizing my leadership there, I felt that it had gone too far, and I felt it incumbent upon me to defend the position. And were I an Austrian, I would have stayed there. I would not have quit. I would have felt that I had an obligation to stay. But I didn't rest until I'd made my point publicly. I got an unofficial apology from the prime minister of the country, who, curiously enough, had been the culture minister before and with whom I worked very well at Sinovats. We got along fine, but as you know, everything has tied up to political events. Kreisky, who was running for re-election, said that he would not stand as prime minister were he not to get an absolute majority, were his party not to get an absolute majority. His party did not get an absolute majority. They had the share power, and he stepped down. The vice prime minister and also the culture minister, Sinovats, then automatically took over. He stepped in, became prime minister, had to give up the culture portfolio, as it's called, and appointed somebody in his own stead. And at that moment, things began to go from bad to worse. Up to that moment, I was enjoying it very much, though it was an enormous amount of work. And after I had that apology and heard that the culture minister would be replaced, as he was several months later, I suddenly realized that at the age of 54, I had no desire to work that hard anymore. And that I was not an Austrian. I had defended the position. And as a foreigner, as I said publicly, I felt that it was time for me to pack my bags and leave. And I was very happy that I did, because it took me a good 4 months just to physically recover from a 20-hour day, just something that I don't think the human body is made to do.
We are really in America not used to that kind of direct political involvement in the arts, and the arts don't have the amount of state subsidy in America that they do in many European countries. So what do you think now about that trade-off? Because the orchestra is probably a lot more secure in many European countries, knowing it's going to have that subsidy from the state. But on the other hand, there's the kind of political conflict like you just outlined for us.
Well, that was a rather unusual situation. Generally speaking, government authorities do not interfere. But there's an indirect interference in that the freedom of action is rather limited by agreements reached by predecessors who are much weaker, who are political appointees, who don't have the artistic punch. Agreements that are negotiated between government and unions, or between the government and the administration of the house. It's not a totally satisfactory situation, unfortunately. There are no totally satisfactory situations, simply because we're dealing with humans and their imperfections in a very imperfect world. And I think a proper mix of subsidy, municipal, state, and federal, with private subsidy is probably the best of both worlds, though that will not guarantee a successful operation by any means. The problem is that one gets too much rigidity. If you set up institutions, then they tend to simply stay there. There's not enough movement. As a free professional, I don't, of course, understand that. In our profession, if we fail two or three times, we've had it. We're through. In other professions today, because of social inequalities and injustices of the past, you can fail all you want or half fail. You're there for good. You're a fixture. And then the people who try to move notes about or words about or cameras about simply have to bounce off the fixtures. And it's unhealthy. And I would like to see more movement. I would like to see more of a guild situation. I'd like to see music run a little bit more like a baseball team where, you know, if you're not hitting, you go off to the minor leagues, and if you don't hit there, well, they farm you out to something else. And if that doesn't work, well, then you'll have to find another job. I mean, you've got to do it. You've got to really deliver. And I think there's much more of a feeling amongst the musicians themselves, if we're talking about musicians. And I wasn't necessarily talking about musicians, but my words may be misinterpreted at this point. That, in fact, the guild situation would be perhaps, in the long run, an improvement. That is where everybody participates, and the good of the whole is considered as being, in fact, good for each individual, rather than each individual feeling that the administration of whatever project owes him something.
Do you mean guild as opposed to union? Or guild as opposed to no union?
No, guild as perhaps opposed to the union management. That is where everyone, conductor, administrator, stage director, stage hand, tuba, and whoever it is who sweeps out the hall, belongs to the same organization, has the same feeling for that organization, and wants it to succeed. And I think we're getting more and more to that feeling. In fact, I think we have de facto guilds in many situations in industry and in the arts. And in ballet, you're beginning to get that. And I think that's great, and I think we're working towards that. And I must say that I think that the United States, socially and politically, is just way ahead of the rest of the world. And I think we're moving forward marvelously. And the spirit in this country is amazing. Actually, what we're doing is pulling the whole world along with us. I don't want to sound necessarily chauvinistic, but with all our problems and all the mistakes we've made, we've got this enthusiasm, this belief in the good life and trying to achieve a better way of life, and this enthusiasm is infectious.
My guest is conductor Lorne Mazel. You've spent a lot of years in Germany and in Vienna conducting there, and I'm not certain about this. I think you're Jewish. I'm not sure about that, but if you are, I would ask you if you felt you encountered anti-Semitism at all in those countries, in Austria or in Germany.
Oh, I didn't realize you were going to bring up the Jewish question.
is this a mistake?
Not at all. Don't mind talking. We're 40 minutes into the interview. It took a long time. Well, it's a very odd question. One can speak, I suppose, only very subjectively. In my particular case, I don't think there was any association in the public mind in Europe for many years. I don't think anybody thought I was or wasn't Jewish. I don't think anybody thought about it. And in fact, until I went to Vienna, it was never mentioned, as far as I know, in the press. And then someone discovered, as Viennese are very good at that, that in fact I am of Jewish background. And so off they went. This sort of thing, well, we mustn't criticize him just because we know he's of Jewish background, because after all, we're over that, and ours is a democratic society. And just because he's Jewish is no reason not to like his Tosca. And of course, the fact that he's Jewish should not deter I mean, that sort of thing. You see, they made it as well known as possible because 25% of the Austrian people admit to being anti-Semitic, and 50% of the Austrians, this is, I'm talking about public polls, admit to some kind of anti-Semitic feeling. All of which I found rather amusing because I think it's incumbent upon us who are younger, who are not victims or participants of the Second World War, that mentality, to help build a better world. And I've always felt that I was part of that movement, as all young people felt after the world. After that world conflagration. And so I was always happy to meet that challenge. A lot of Jewish people who have a heightened sense of Jewish consciousness have reacted quite differently. People like Menuhin have gone right back to Germany and had given concerts with Furtwängler, because he said, look, Furtwängler is one of the few Germans in position of authority who stood up to the Nazis and protected his Jewish the Jewish members of his orchestra, and it would be unfair of me as a Jewish person not to recognize that and to go back to country and to make contact with the new Germans, who it is to be presumed will be free of that. Other people whose relatives were, like Rubinstein, burned up in concentration camps, felt that they could never set foot in that country or hear the language again. I can understand that. I respect all these attitudes. Obviously, because of the Middle East situation, the inherent anti-Semitism has been exploited for purely political reasons. And I think were it not for that rather odd situation in the Middle East, anti-Semitism would have probably just been buried along with a lot of the antagonisms of the Second World War. I think it's been artificially resurrected in Europe. How important a role it plays, I really don't know. But I must say that I was absolutely stupefied to read in the American press that we are to be grateful that a good number of the farmers in the Midwest do not think that the present agricultural crisis is due to the machinations of international Jewish bankers. I mean, I can't understand a statement like that. I thought that all the Jewish bankers were incarcerated and cremated during the last war. I mean, there are no international Jewish bankers other than the, you know, 0.1% of people who've come up after the Second World War. And that myth could still be wandering around in some place as nice as our own Midwest strikes me as being absolutely mind-boggling. But this is a sort of sign of the illogic of human beings that one has to deal with every place in the world.
So did anti-Semitism have anything to do with you leaving Vienna?
Oh, certainly not. certainly not because of my enemies, and I had quite a few, I think may or may not have had anti-Semitic feelings, but the last thing they would have done, since there was so much publicity attached to this confrontation, would have been to have public resort that kind of feeling. Quite the contrary, they dealt with the situation politically, and I was able to defend my position politically by saying publicly that though I had an axe to grind, it was not a racial one; it was purely an artistic one. And mind you, I was engaged with the full knowledge on the part of Sinowatz that I was of a Jewish background, so I don't think that played any role. I, as a person, find the whole question academic and very odd, because it has nothing whatever to do with my inner view of myself or the world. I feel myself to be a member of only one race, and that is a human race, and my allegiance is to a culture, the American culture, which I've grown up in and have been formed by and rather admire. But other than that, you know, I'm a human being like everybody else, and find myself out there defending one small part of the human race, it strikes me as being very odd. Nevertheless, I do it very happily, because were I a political activist, I might just as well have been out 25 years ago defending the rights of the blacks, not being black. Well, why should I defend the right then of the Jewish minority just because I happen to be Jewish? That would be illogical.
Yeah, right. My guest is conductor Lorne Mazel. Throughout your career, I think you've done a lot of guest conducting, and you're really among the more prominent of the, quote, jet set conductors. And I guess I wonder how you've tried to achieve a balance when you've been an artistic director of an orchestra at the time, between guest conducting in other places and, you know, having a stable life with the orchestra and building them up. What seemed to you to be the appropriate balance to maintain?
But that's just the point. I was one of the few directors who really took the business of directing and administrating very seriously. I just didn't wander away from home base. In Cleveland, I don't know, I never looked at the statistics, but having conducted two-thirds of the winter season, half the summer season, all the tours, all the recordings, all the television, my guess is that probably during the 10 years I was with that orchestra, I conducted the orchestra more than George Sell did in 20. Not that he wasn't devoted to his orchestra, but the moment the last notes faded away, they had a six-month season. I had a 10-and-a-half-month season. He left, he was on the first plane back to Switzerland and didn't reappear until the first note of the next season. And of course, when our summer season or their summer season was set up, he had never had anything to do with it. It was in his contract. So I really took it very, very seriously, took my job in Berlin very seriously, and took my job in Vienna very seriously. So I hardly guest conducted in those 20 years, which is one of the few reasons, one of the basic reasons for which, having left the Vienna State Opera rather abruptly at the end of June in 84, that I set out on this, what I immodestly called, I suppose, a world tour, a 2.5-year trek about the world to meet the people who apparently have come to know me through television recordings. I mean, the New Year's concert, for better or for worse, is beamed to something like 750 million people every January 1, and a lot of people get to know you, get to know your face, and get to know your music making. And I thought I would just go out there and travel with five or six orchestras, which I like, and also present at the same time the fruits of a long-standing relationship with those orchestras, specifically the Vienna Philharmonic. We were in South America, three concerts in Carnegie Hall, going to Japan next month. The Munich Philharmonic, which had never appeared in the United States. I was the first American to appear with a German orchestra in the United States after the war. We stumbled on that odd statistic, and that was just last year, last October 1985. And I was very happy to do that because the new Germany is undoubtedly much more democratic than some of the older, more democratic countries. The National Orchestra of France, that a tour in Scandinavia, Europe, and the United States next year. The Chamber Orchestra of Europe, made up of the cream of the young people who've left the European Community Orchestra. They're all between the ages of 23 and 30. Absolutely amazing orchestra, about 40 people, the very finest young players available these days. And, of course, the Pittsburgh Symphony, with which I have given quite a few concerts now in the last couple of years and have toured.
So you welcome now the chance to tour more than you were when you were committed to directing one orchestra.
Well, yes, that was the purpose of these 2.5 years, simply to go out and meet all these people and have them actually see me in person rather than buying a record or whatever. And then I'm going off to my sabbatical of January 1, 1988, and it's no concerts, any place, for any reason.
When you guest conduct, the orchestra already has grown accustomed to playing in a certain way and under a certain kind of direction. How much can you imprint your personality or your style on them for the period that you're going to be guest conducting? How much does it seem appropriate to do that, or do you feel like you have to lay back a little bit for that period because you're not there full time? You know, you're like the substitute teacher in a way when you're guest conducting.
Substitute teacher, I love it. Considering what my children say about their subs.
Considering what does done to subs, though, that's not
quite a category.
Sure, that doesn't happen to you when you're guest conducting.
Well, I suppose at a certain point, if you're perceived to be in a certain category, these questions really become irrelevant. People are alert and they're keen and they respect you before you've begun reading a note. And conducting is really mental energy, focused like a radio beam, okay? What I want is right in my mind, and it's going through my arm, through the baton, and through my whole being. And that really is the art of conducting, this ability to communicate with intensity and great clarity, so that right from the first beat, I think whatever it is, a student orchestra or an orchestra I've worked with for years really knows what I want. They feel it and they respond to it, for better or for worse.
When an audience shows up at a concert, what they see of the conductor's work isn't all the rehearsal and the behind-the-scenes stuff and the administrative work that the conductor's done. They see the conductor in the performance. And a lot of conductors are really showmen, you know, and have quite a stage presence. How important do you think that is as a conductor to give a good performance for the audience? And I don't even mean musically, but I mean the performance of waving the arms. And
yeah, well, you can't really divide one from the other. I use the word showman. That has a pejorative connotation. You're not showing anything. What you're doing is moving your baton in a very functional way in order to achieve a certain effect. To get the music across, that in itself is all that an audience needs, because they feel the truth of it. It's like standing before a television camera. No one can hide behind a camera. No one can hide on stage. Stage presence really means that you're successfully communicating an interpretation of a work. You're making whatever it is you're doing, if you're an actor, conductor, whatever, singer, come alive. People feel that. Because that's why they go to performance. They want to participate in something which is coming alive before their eyes, and something that will touch them, and which they will be able to leave the hall with deeply in their hearts. And if you succeed, you are a true interpreter. If you don't, nothing can help you. All the flailing about won't help you at all.
Let's talk about the concert that you're here to conduct. On Saturday, you're going to be conducting Verdi's Requiem with a chorus of 350 voices. The Opera Company Philadelphia's orchestra, Luciano Pavarotti, will be performing. Three winners of the Luciano Pavarotti Voice Competition will be performing as well. And you're doing it at the Spectrum, which isn't the first place that comes to mind for opera performances. What was your first thought when they said, were you going to be performing at a sports arena?
Well, it's a decision, obviously, I participated in and seconded, because I think that I may be one of the pioneers in this kind of concert. I opened, for example, a sports stadium in Paris, Bercy, with a performance of the Berlioz Requiem. That was many, many years ago. And I've given many performances in large sports stadium because I believe it can be done. It needs to be acoustically finessed. There's no question about it. But in fact, we had no unpleasant surprises today. I had no difficulty working in that hall, and in fact, it's a great improvement over the mammoth hall I used to give some concerts with the Cleveland Orchestra in the 70s.
Are there any acoustic characteristics that you have to, as you said, finesse or compensate for in a place like the Spectrum?
Well, the sound is being supported. I wouldn't say it's being amplified, because that would distort the sound. It's being supported. The acoustical apparatuses, let's say, at our disposal today are very, very refined and very, very sensitive. And they can support the sound, give it dimension without doing an injustice to the timbre, to the quality of the sound. That's very important. These people are absolutely amazing. I'd like to say a few words about the competition, just as an outsider. I really didn't know very much about it. It is an amazing undertaking, and I think Luciano's guiding spirit there has been extremely beneficial and very productive and very important as an ex opera director and manager. I can tell you how important it is that young voices be fed into the mainstream of the opera world, because the pickings were becoming leaner and leaner. We have three young artists, Susan Dunn, Miss Kumloji, and Mr. Pata Buchalatsim, American, Hungarian, and Georgian from Soviet Russia, in that order, all of whom are superb. I'm just absolutely superb, amazing. They're all going to have first-class careers. And these are competition winners. For Luciano to come up with three winners like that, and those are just some of the many, is an amazing accomplishment, and it's due to the way in which he's gone about this, which has been extremely intelligent and very supportive for young people.
Do you think that locating the concert at the Spectrum will attract people beyond the regular opera-going audience?
Well, I think so. In fact, there's so many people out there who are really interested in music, who buy records. I mean, that funny figure you mentioned, 2 million records last year, okay, I happen to have conducted them. Somebody else might have. But that in the classical field is an amazing number. I mean, just that's way out of sight. People didn't sell that number of records in the classical field in a year. That means that music is loved by a great number of people, and these mammoth concerts will bring music to ever greater number of people under circumstances where people feel comfortable.
Well, I want to thank you very much for taking some time out from your busy schedule to talk with us today. Thank you so much for being here.
Well, thanks for having me. It's great fun.
My guest has been conductor Lauren Mazel, who's in Philadelphia to conduct a concert performance of Verdi's Requiem featuring Luciano Pavarotti and three winners of the Opera Company's Luciano Pavarotti International Voice Competition. There'll be a chorus of 350 voices. The performance is under the auspices of the Opera Company of Philadelphia. It's Saturday night at 8:30 at the Spectrum, and it will also be videotaped for broadcast Wednesday, June 11th on public television. For information about the concert, you can call 732-5813. That's 732-5813. And Lauren Mazel, thank you again for being with us.
Bye now.
It's 2 minutes to 5. We'll be joining National Public Radio at 5 for All Things Considered. I'll tell you what's happening tomorrow afternoon on Fresh Air, but first, let's check in with Shadow Traffic.
A jam traffic this afternoon on the Schuylkill Expressway westbound. At least 30 minutes in traffic from Montgomery Drive to a point west of City Avenue. Complicating things, there's a tractor-trailer accident on the shoulder. Also an accident at the Montgomery Drive exit ramp. That's also on the shoulder. In Center City, police are checking the report of an accident at 8th and Vine, 95 northbound. A 5-minute delay approaching the area of the Ben Franklin Bridge. That's Shadow Traffic. I'm John Butterworth on 91 FM WHYY.
That Shadow Traffic Report was funded by the Sussman Organization. Tomorrow afternoon on Fresh Air at 3 o'clock, Danny Miller will speak with Lenny Siegel, author of The High Cost of High Tech, The Dark Side of the Chip. At 3:40, Christiane Vaillancourt will report on the arts. She usually reports Thursdays on Fresh Air, but this afternoon we had to preempt her report in order to accommodate a National Press Club broadcast, which we heard earlier today. Also tomorrow afternoon at 4 o'clock, we'll be joined by comedian Phyllis Diller. So that's all coming up tomorrow afternoon on Fresh Air. This Sunday at 6 on the Best of Fresh Air, we'll hear from TV talk show host and actor and comedian Dick Cavett. So hope you can be listening. That about does it for today's program. If you have any questions or comments, we hope you'll write to us at Fresh Air, WHYY Radio, 150 North 6th Street, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, 19106. Ron Barron and Joyce Lieberman were the engineers for today's show. Production assistance from Millie Moffitt. Amy Salad is the associate producer. Danny Miller co-produces the show. My name's Terry Gross. I want to thank you for listening, and I wish you a very good evening. This is WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. We're listener-supported public radio in the Delaware Valley. Stay tuned for All Things Considered coming up from National Public Radio, followed at 6:29 by 91 Report, our regional news magazine.
Local transmission of All Things Considered Today is made possible in part by a grant from Bartash Publications, who specialize in the printing of newspapers, circulars, television books, and catalogs.
Good evening. From National Public Radio in Washington, I'm Wendy Kaufman.
This is Noah Adams with All Things Considered.
Bombs don't look like the cartoon thing, you know, with a round ball and a fuse sticking out the end that's fizzing. You know, you can make a bomb look like a can of shaving cream.
The difficulty of stopping a terrorist bombing proven again yesterday in the skies over Greece. Tonight on All Things Considered, authorities name the person they believe left a bomb on TWA Flight 840.
And these stories, the Rogers Commission taking public testimony about the Challenger explosion, hearing from the astronauts themselves.
The government of Honduras charging the Reagan administration with overstating the case of the recent Sandinista incursion.
A report on a group in Arizona trying to live outside the laws of any government.
And the three-point play coming for college basketball.
First, this news.
This is Laurie Waffenschmidt. Greek and Italian authorities say they're looking for an Arab woman terrorist who is believed to have been on a TWA jet yesterday, hours before a bomb exploded on the aircraft, killing four people. They suspect May Mansour planted the explosive on the flight she took from Cairo to Athens. The plane then went on to Rome and began its return trip to Athens before the blast. A pro-Libyan terrorist group called the Arab Revolutionary Cells has claimed responsibility for the bombing, but the Reagan administration says it hasn't ruled out any terrorist group or individual, and State Department spokesman Bernard Kalb condemned the attack.
These terrorist attacks are vicious, and we condemn them in the strongest possible terms. Such attacks in which four innocent persons, including a baby, plunging miles to their death, are entirely unjustified and do not gain sympathy for whatever cause the perpetrators are advocating.
Mansour's nationality is not known, nor what group she may represent, but she is suspected of involvement in several other airline bomb attacks. Several astronauts testified today before the Presidential Commission investigating the shuttle disaster. Among them was Chief Astronaut John Young, who wrote a memo last month charging that NASA officials were risking the lives of the astronauts by putting flight schedule above safety. But as NPR's Daniel Swerdling reports, Young's testimony today was very different.
During more than 4 hours at the witness table, along with colleagues from Johnson Space Center, Young repeated almost none of the angry charges that he'd made in his widely publicized memos. He did repeat some safety problems on the shuttle, which he feels need to be fixed, and he said the shuttle accident shows that NASA needs to improve its internal communications, something almost everyone now agrees on. But Young would not suggest in any way that NASA officials had sacrificed safety to meet the launch schedule. In fact, in both their tone and words, all the astronauts at today's hearing, including Henry Hartsfield, P.J. Weitz, Bob Crippen, and Young, indicated that they strongly support NASA. They support the space program. They're all working as a team. They showed none of the signs of the bitter NASA infighting that's been widely reported in the press. Both the astronauts and Commission Chairman William Rogers said they'd like to see a new independent safety review panel set up in NASA, a sort of safety ombudsman that can spend full time from now on reviewing potential safety concerns. I'm Daniel Swerdling in Washington.
In South Africa, the status of Winnie Mandela is being disputed. Yesterday, her attorney said an order banning Mandela from her home in Soweto was lifted, but a spokesman for the Law and Order Ministry says the order is still in effect. Mandela has returned to her home. It's not clear whether police will allow her to remain. At least two blacks were killed today as police fired on crowds attending a funeral in a township outside Johannesburg. And in this country, nearly 100 people were arrested as police moved in on a shanty town set up on the University of California campus at Berkeley. At least 29 people were injured in the fighting between police and demonstrators. The United Nations mediator on Afghanistan, Diego Cordovez, says both Pakistan and Afghanistan have agreed to resume negotiations on the withdrawal of Soviet troops from Afghanistan. Michael Kallenbach reports from the UN.
Cordovez has now set May the 5th as the date for the next round of talks in Geneva. But since Pakistan does not want to give legitimacy to the Afghan regime, it has refused to meet face-to-face with them. As a compromise arrangement, it's Cordovez who shuttles from room to room, conveying the different points of view. Nevertheless, he is hopeful that the next round of talks will provide some concrete results which might get the two parties to meet head-on to work out a timetable for Soviet troop withdrawal from Afghanistan. In typical UN fashion, Cordovez refused to be drawn on any firm details about the next round of talks. This time, the normally over-optimistic negotiator said he remained hopeful, since the two sides will, as he put it, go straight to the heart of the matter. For National Public Radio, this is Michael Kallenbach at the United Nations.
The Austrian office of the Young and Rubicam Advertising Agency has canceled its contract with former UN Secretary General Kurt Waldheim because of his wartime activities. Allegations have been raised that Waldheim was a senior officer on the staff of a Nazi war criminal. Young and Rubicam was handling political advertising for Waldheim's race for president of Austria. The Internal Revenue Service is asking Congress for an additional $340 million in operating funds to process the flood of returns it expects to receive in the next 2 weeks. IRS Commissioner Roscoe Egger said that without the funds, the agency would be faced with a disaster that could result in delays and filing problems for taxpayers. Last year, errors in the new computer system caused a massive backlog in processing returns. According to Egger, the computer problems had been worked out. On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average closed off nearly 29 points at 1766.40. I'm Lori Waffenschmidt in Washington.
Investigators from several European countries and the United States are trying to find out who planted the bomb that exploded yesterday on TWA Flight 840 as the plane approached the airport in Athens. From Rome, Sylvia Pagioli reports that Italian police say the bomb may have been brought aboard in carry-on baggage during a stopover in Cairo.
Italian investigators, who are cooperating closely with Greek authorities and the FBI, believe that the bomb that ripped open a hole in the TWA airliner was placed by an Arab passenger whose last name was identified as Mansour. A TWA spokesman confirmed that a woman named May Mansour boarded the plane in Cairo and sat in seat 10F, the same seat under which the bomb was concealed. The passenger got off at the next stop, Athens, 4 hours before the explosion. Italian police believe the terrorist may have hidden the explosives and timer under the seat where life jackets are stored. The plane then continued its flight to Rome, where it underwent inspection by TWA's private security force before departing once again for Athens. Investigators point out that if the explosives were made of plastic, it is possible they could not be detected by electronic scanners. Italian Minister of the Interior, Oscar Luigi Scalfaro, told reporters today that a terrorist suspect identified as Mansour has been in Italian police files since 1983. When an attempt was made to place a bomb on an Alitalia flight from Istanbul to Rome. The only claim for yesterday's plane bombing was made last night in Beirut by a group calling itself the Al-Qassam Unit of Arab Revolutionary Cells, an unknown organization in the galaxy of Arab terrorism. A group calling itself Arab Revolutionary Cells was one of those that claimed responsibility for the December attack on Rome's Fiumicino airport that left 16 dead. Since that attack, Italian authorities say security at the airport has been significantly upgraded. And since the Gulf of Sidra clashes last month, El Al and TWA flights out of Rome are considered high risk and under particular surveillance. Airport officials in Rome point out all carry-on luggage and all baggage and freight originated in Rome was X-rayed. They even go so far to say that if any of the passengers boarding in Rome had been carrying an Arab passport, security checks would have been even more specific. But of the 12 passengers who boarded in Rome, none was considered suspects. For National Public Radio, this is Sylvia Poggioli in Rome.
Egyptian officials are unhappy about reports that the suspect in the TWA bombing boarded the plane in Egypt. The BBC's Jack Thompson spoke with a high official in the Egyptian Interior Ministry who defended safety measures at the Cairo airport.
The Egyptians are insisting that when the flight took off from Cairo, it was clean, as the ministry spokesman put it. And he said it was unreasonable to blame Egypt every time something like this happened. My own experience confirms that since the hijacking of an Egyptian airliner to Malta in November last year, security at Cairo Airport has been tightened considerably. Hand-carried luggage is screened twice, often three times, through electronic scanners, and passengers are subjected to body searches. On some flights, especially those to other destinations in the Middle East, passengers must identify their checked-in luggage on the tarmac before it's loaded into the aircraft hold. All ground staff at Cairo Airport are issued with plastic identity cards displaying a photograph which must be